Dr. Richard Brockman is a clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. He is an attending clinical psychiatrist at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. His newest book is Life After Death. Welcome, Richard.
Welcome. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, excited to have you on. Tell us a little bit about your personal life, some more about your work, and why you do what you do.
Why I do what I do is a long answer, and it's kind of in the context of the book to a certain degree. My mother committed suicide when I was seven years, 2 months, and 2 days old, which has a lot to do with my psyche, my story, my career choice, and why I do what I do. So it's more than a sentence or two, I think. And it's a book, actually. Because the book is very much the story of my, it's in one sense, it's a memoir in that it is my story, but it's also my story is how I became a psychiatrist, how I became a neuroscientist, and using my knowledge base and science base as a psychiatrist, but especially as a neuroscientist to understand myself. So I'm both the subject and the object of this investigation, if you will. And why I do with what I do is not as straightforward as it might seem, in that a lot of the struggle of dealing with parental suicide, especially a mother, especially as early, I mean, around seven is where a child understands that life is not forever and that death is real. Up until, you know, six, you sort of get it. Five, you really don't. Eight, you've got it. Seven is that transition. So I was at that transition point of, I understood that my mother's death was final, even though I spent quite a few months, I don't say hallucinating, but she sort of stayed around in my mind for quite a few months. But it's traumatic, it's disorganizing, and a lot of my youth and early adulthood was kind of, in some ways, trying to get her to talk to me, to conjure her up, I wasn't crazy, but it was, I don't think it was all that unusual that you demand some form of an answer from someone who's killed themselves, especially a mother. And so a lot of who I was that. And I didn't become a psychiatrist because I wanted to cure the world or be a healer. I became a psychiatrist because I didn't know who I was for several decades. And then it sort of made a certain sense that I went into medicine and psychiatry because of my mother. And then eventually along the way, I let go of her and sort of discovered who I was. But I don't think I knew who I was until I was close to 30, which is not on the young side for identity formation. It would have been nice if I'd known who I was when I was seven, and that her suicide just destroyed that notion of who I was. So I had to sort of start all over again at age seven, which it took a while. So it's a long answer.
How do you think about it now?
Her suicide?
Yes.
Well, I about halfway through writing this book, I realized I was going to dedicate it. The dedication is for Ruth, my mother. That's my mother, Ruth. And at some point, I just started to realize how much she really gave me. She was bipolar depressed, which is, it's got a 15% untreated bipolar depression has a 15% suicide risk. Hmm. She's like that's 1 in 8. That's like, oh my God, that's really high. I'm untreated. And when she was in the throes of her illness, it was back when there really wasn't a treatment for bipolar depression. I mean, lithium had been discovered, but it wasn't in particularly wide use. It really wasn't known. There were no antidepressants. Barbiturates were the main thing that was used. I mean, psychiatry was in the throes of post-World War II psychoanalysis, and that was not helpful at all for bipolar depression. The way she died, and the fact that I found her, just threw me into a big tailspin.
I can't even imagine. I have a 7-year-old. I can't imagine him. You know, just I appreciate the age and how they sort of operate in the world. And I don't know. You talked about how right at that age, you sort of have an idea about death, or you're getting an idea of it. And I wonder about him. We've experienced loss in our family, and so we've talked about it, but certainly nothing to the extent of what you're dealing with
I'm sorry. Usually you experience death at that age by a canary, a cat, your dog. Mm-hmm. You see a deer by the road. Something is dead, or you find a mouse, whatever, that's dead. And you kind of explore it starting at about that age. And it starts to become clear that this dead mouse is not about to start hopping up and down again, or the dog really is dead. And you sort of begin to go through the mourning process. You begin to understand it as final, and therefore you really mourn its loss. Up until then, you know, 6-year-old, it's a little bit still magical, and it's a little bit like sleep, and they're going to wake up, and you don't give up. You don't give that up quickly. And it's usually you have to understand it, which is, it's traditionally been said at age 7. So, you know, up until then, I lived in an area of Brooklyn that was, it was pretty protected. I mean, it was, there weren't a lot of cars and there weren't main roads. So it was like, and I had a bicycle, and it was like, oh my God, I am the king of the universe. It was like getting this bike was like having a Harley Davidson with wings. I was just thrilled with my life and how my power and the magic. And we lived near Coney Island, so there was it's an amusement park. I mean, it used to be a big deal amusement park. Now it's a little bit weird, but it was always weird, but now it's really very weird. But so it was, there was real magic and theatric and street theater, and it wasn't Commedia dell'arte. It wasn't the Italian sort of commedia, but it was street sort of fantasy and clowns and stuff on the street, which is all, you know, every summer. It was sort of right in my backyard. Like, just again, I had a bike. So, and then that sense of adventure and power and just exploration, where I had gone to the ends of the world as far as I was concerned. I'd never left Brooklyn at that point, but as far as I was concerned, I mastered the world, and then everything collapsed. So it was traumatic.
Yeah. Did you go to traditional undergraduate at the traditional time after high school? Walk me through how you found your way into medicine.
I did. The Vietnam War was still happening, and there was a huge amount of protest against the Vietnam War, and it was a war that was popularly seen as ridiculous, as why are 52,000 American soldiers killed? Why did they die? What were they fighting for? What was the country trying to do in Southeast Asia? And very few people amongst those that I knew said, yes, what a great idea. I'm going to become a soldier. And so It's a long way of explaining. I would have been thrilled if I could have taken some time off from college, or from between high school and college, just to figure myself out and to figure things out better. And it made it. I was not ready to go to college, but I was also not about to sort of volunteer to go to Vietnam. And again, that sounds somewhat less patriotic now. Back then, it was very different than I'll become a soldier. That's the patriotic thing to do. Back then, becoming a soldier for Vietnam was like really questionable judgment as to why am I trying to kill Southeast Asians, and what, you know, for what? What's the goal? What's the good of it? And I think, I mean, it became clear that it wasn't a good idea, et cetera. But again, that's one way of explaining how come I went straight to college when I was not ready to go to college, because I didn't know who I was or what I wanted, and needed more time just to kind of bump into walls and just hit some dead ends and say, this is serious. I really don't know what I'm doing, and I really need to figure this out. And college helped me to avoid that for 4 years. And that's basically what my college education was avoiding facing issues that I really needed to face. So I went, my entry into medical school came 3 or 4 years later, when I began to realize that I did want to heal people, and that I wasn't just angry at the world anymore. That I wasn't quite so angry with my mother anymore, and indeed started to feel that I wanted to heal her in some abstract way, and heal, to be a healer in a not at all abstract way, in a very real way.
Do you ever wonder what you would have been doing had she not killed herself?
Probably trying to design a Harley Davidson with wings.
Okay, right.
I don't know exactly.
There's still time, Richard.
Yes, so why not? I have to talk to the Harley Davidson Corporation if they've come up with anyone sort of proposed that to them yet.
Right.
I guess you could say the Hells Angels were part of that. A Harley Davidson with wings, but I don't know.
You could have been a member of the Hells Angels, Richard.
I think I'm too skinny, to be honest, and for any number of different reasons, I probably was not
sure
in that direction.
Being a soldier, not in the cards. Being a member of the Hells Angels, not in the cards. There is a lot of room in between those things. Well, so, and now you spend a good amount of time, or have, in Namibia. How does that factor into all of this, if at all?
I went to Africa, I don't know, 15 years ago, just because I'd never been. It was more than that. I was actually asked to lecture at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. And since I was going to be that deep into Africa and that far away from home, I thought, well, I'll stay here for a while. And just, again, had a fabulous time in Cape Town and talking, but a really amazing time in Zambia, which is next door. And then it was sort of circumstance that I met someone who said, what are you doing? I mean, just sort of a conversation. And suddenly I had a name of someone at the University of Namibia in the Department of Physiology, and I got in touch with him. And following year, I went back as a professor, or not, as a visiting professor of neuroscience, and just loved it. I mean, just loved the students, loved the place, loved the challenges of medicine in Namibia, and kept doing it until till COVID, when it just became, I mean, the university withdrew sort of any support. If said, if you want to go travel, you're on your own, we're not going to help you. If you get sick, good luck. I mean, it just became seriously problematic. And at the beginning of the COVID, as you're sure you remember, it was like people got sick and got really sick, and you just needed a major support system to feel safe, that you had access to it. And I knew there wouldn't be access to it in Namibia. And so for a while I didn't go. But I really do love teaching in Africa.
I appreciate that. So what are you hoping that people get out of the book when they pick up Life After Death? What do you hope they get out of it?
It's not really a book about suicide, and it's not really about a book about childhood trauma, both of which I've faced. It's really about surviving it. And most specifically, it's about story. That one of the things I wrote about before this book, and I believe, is that we mammals, not just you and me, but mammals, our brain is structured that we think in the structure of story. And that there's some good work with rodents and with canines and with people and with Homo sapiens, that our memories work much better when there's a story structure than when there are bits of data, that we have to put the data together, and then your hippocampus and your parts of your brain record it better and structure it. And that with childhood trauma, or with trauma at any age, if it's significant trauma, that story gets shattered. It gets challenged and sometimes broken apart. So as a 7-year-old, for me, my story as this conquistador with a bicycle in Brooklyn got destroyed, and I had to put it back together or come up with a new one. And I think the book is really about story, both narrative story as well as the biology of story. So it does tell two stories. The book has two threads. One is the narrative, which is my narrative, my life. But the other is the biological, the neurobiological of story itself, how story is generated, how it's formed, how it's set down in the brain, how traumatic, significant trauma, overwhelming trauma can disrupt story. And then it's about putting that story back together, which can take time, it almost invariably takes time. It's not something that no one has some, you know, you sing a song and hold hands and you're fine. It's like, no, it's like it's that they sing songs. I'm not, and holding hands is one of the many pieces of recreation of safety. Safety has to be reestablished, and then narrative has to get reestablished, and then biology has to get reestablished. So the book is really more about the reestablishment of safety, of narrative, and and the biology of story. And it's even got some humor also. So it's not about suicide, but it is about negotiating or being struck by trauma and then getting past it and through it and moving on.
You mentioned earlier that it took until about age 30 to figure out who you were. Is that around the time that you were I don't know if you ever fully recover from something like this or not. Close to recovery, on your way to recovery?
I think it was a piece of recovery because I was acting out in, I'm a child of the 60s where basically no behavior was considered acting out because whatever you did kind of was contained within the zeitgeist. But, friends died. I mean, people, cocaine was felt, until people started dying, cocaine was felt to be the drug of choice. It was like, oh boy, why not? People didn't realize that all this stuff had problems with it. And it wasn't a get out of jail free pass. And even if you were in jail, which I was a few times. So I was beginning to understand that life really required a better story than the one I was traveling on and traveling or letting guide me. And again, story is biologically a guide. It's how you can sort of see, well, this once upon a time there was, and then this happened, and this happened, and then this happened. That's like a story. But it's also your memory thinks of this happened and that happened. Well, if those two things happen, then the most likely next thing is that thing. It sets up a view of the future. And that's the view of how you remember the past is how you anticipate the future. That's biology. It's not a narrative. It is a narrative, but it's also a biological function. And I was beginning to get that in my 20s. And then when I got into medical school and went to medical school, suddenly having that much work and having to memorize that much and having to learn so quickly that much stuff, suddenly I think I was lucky that I just actually enjoyed it and found it exciting. And suddenly that was what I wanted to do, was learn all this fabulous stuff. And I think that really pulled me out of myself. And I needed to get pulled out of myself because I was deeply in a bad, being in myself was to be in total confusion. And that's where I was. And that's where it wasn't as if I decided, when my mother killed herself, I will become a psychiatrist. It's like, no, it was really a back door. I was just so confused if I look back on it. And then that just started to shift when I was kind of thinking, medical school, maybe. And, I was a philosophy major. So, working my way to a convincing admissions office that I could do all this hard science, I had to sort of convince them. And that also was like, I can do this. It was another identity forming moment. But pulling myself out of who I was as important as showing me who I might want to be. And again, it was years. It didn't happen in a few weeks. This is a few years, or many years, actually. And I think that's one of the messages of trauma is give it. It demands respect. It's like it's vicious. I mean, I'm talking about big deal trauma. It's vicious, and it disorganizes biologically, and you cannot, if you get impatient with it, you'll be in trouble. And, I think I was impatient with it. And, the 60s were a great time if you're impatient, well, there's all kinds of solutions. It's like, I'm not saying any of them were particularly good. And they didn't give you much, except they killed a lot of time. And they killed a few of your friends. And they may have killed you too. So, but it's, despite having said all that, it's actually a book about, it's a generative book, because it's surviving suicide, not succumbing to suicide, and having the structure and to a certain degree, even the guide. I mean, it's not a handbook, it's not a how-to, but there is a hand out to people who are struggling because I am a healer, finally.
Well, I appreciate you sharing your story and writing the book. Thank you so much for coming on. Where can people learn more about you? Where can they get their copy of Life After Death?
Well, they, of course, can go to Amazon, but you should. The better choice would be a local bookstore. And if they don't have it, get really indignant as to why they don't have it, and tell your that it's a great book and it should be on their books, should be on their front table, even if it's not. But they should buy it from their local bookstore. But it is on all the major websites. You can, I mean, obviously there's the internet. One can look up Richard Brockman, Life After Death, but I think read the book. Or I'll be teaching in Addis Ababa in May. So if you want to come and take a course in Ethiopia, I'd be happy to have you in the class.
Perfect. I love it. But if you enjoyed as much as I did, show Richard your appreciation and share today's show with a friend who also appreciates good ideas. Pick up your copy of Life After Death at your local bookstore, come hell or high water, or worst case scenario, Amazon. And then go check out Richard's class in Ethiopia this coming May as well. And you'll have to figure that one out on your own. Thanks again, Richard.
Thank you very much. Really, my best. Till next Arizona.
Thank you. Until next time, remember, do your part by doing your best.
Thank you.